Hello everyone, this is Jose Saavedra and today I'm here with Jonathan Wilson. He is the Aviation Services Manager with KPG Inc. KPG Inc. was founded in 1990 as a multidisciplinary professional services company. They work primarily with public sector clients, offering a variety of design, engineering, architectural, and many more services. Jonathan has extensive experience as an aviation industry leader, having held leadership positions at the General Aviation Airport in the Seattle area. Jonathan, I want to thank you for taking the time to join me today and participating in this interview. How are you?
Hi, doing well. Thanks for having me.
Perfect. Why don't we go ahead and let's just get started. And I'm going to start by asking you to share a little bit about your background and your professional experience in the aviation industry.
So, I've been around airplanes for a long time, learned how to fly them back about 2000, so 18 years ago. And at the time, I was going to become a commercial pilot. Wanted to become a commercial pilot, went to school for that, got my pilot training underway. And not long after, we had 9/11, and that really changed the really changed the equation for me. That industry changed overnight as a result of that. And a lot of folks that I knew who were flying in the regionals were getting laid off, were getting furloughed. And I thought, maybe I should change direction a little bit. So at the time, I was still in college and changed over to an airport management degree, a different track. And still continued to fly a little bit on the side, but mainly started to focus on the business side of airports and aviation. And I came out of there in 2002, that was the economy was terrible in June of 2002 as a fallout from what happened earlier. And so it took a few years, but eventually I finished up with some graduate school and got my position with the Renton Airport up here in Renton, Washington, which is a small airport. It's a general aviation airport, a reliever airport for SeaTac International. So we did more than 100,000 ops a year, and with a staff of probably a dozen of us total, some seasonal folks who came and went. And so I was there for at the city of Renton, who owned the Renton Airport, is with them for almost 10 years. I was first the assistant manager, then as the airport manager. And after that, got recruited by KPG to start their aviation services division here, which is where I'm at today.
Yeah, perfect. So I think it's really interesting that you mentioned your change in career from starting as a wanting to become a pilot and into the airport industry. In the past, I had heard some a comment that said that every good airport manager starts wanting to be a pilot.
And I think that's true. I've met a number of us out there who started out wanting to be commercial pilots and ended up working the desk at the airport.
Yeah, and that's definitely my experience as well. I started wanting to be a commercial airline pilot and eventually transition into the airport management area. So I think you had definitely had the opportunity to get some hands-on experience working at Renton and moving on the leadership positions that you held there. So I think that in that regards, it kind of set you up to where to get you as the aviation services manager. So why don't you talk a little bit more about your role at KPG? And what really entails, what your job entails as an aviation service manager?
Sure. So KPG, as you said in your intro, we've been around for almost 30 years here in the Seattle area. And for the longest time, it was just a couple of guys who worked in Seattle. And over the years, the company has grown to what we call an interdisciplinary company. So we're at over 100 people now, and folks are working in architecture and landscape architecture, survey, engineering, traffic planning, and more, a number of different divisions. The newest division is aviation services. So I'm the aviation services manager here, which nice title, but for right now, it's me just getting this department onto its feet. So I've been here for almost 2 years. The department itself is also almost 2 years old, but in that time, we've had a number of good wins in the local area. So KPG is pretty localized, has historically been pretty localized to the Seattle area, Puget Sound area, serving Puget Sound cities and some private clients, but mainly public clients. And over the years we've grown, we're in four offices now, Seattle and Tacoma and Bellevue, and then one in the middle of Washington State, Wenatchee. And so started here a couple of years ago. And so my job was to essentially build the aviation division itself, build a presence in doing airport and aviation work.
Sure, and I think that's it sounds like the company has gone through some massive changes, going from a couple guys to over 100 employees. So it, specifically, what I noticed looking at your website is that, again, like you mentioned, you were brought in to sort of get the aviation division growing. So why don't you describe a little bit what your role was in establishing and developing, or, you know, making that department grow at KPG?
On this side of, I'll back up a little bit, as an airport manager, we would hire companies like KPG to come in and provide consulting services. And consulting in this respect is folks who know architecture, folks who know engineering, folks who know surveying, who can come in and help us solve those sort of problems. Like, we need to build a new taxiway. We need to refinish our runway. And so that's what we do here. So my job on this side of the table, on the consultant side of the table, is to essentially manage those projects on behalf of the airports and the clients that we work with. So my job is to, in this role, is to organize resources, to organize people and processes, such that we can deliver our professional services in a way that our clients expect, and the way that we've told them that we can deliver them. So that's my job is here. I'm not an engineer. I'm not an architect, but I have those people who I am coordinating with who are on these projects. And so my job a lot of the day is to organize, get people organized around projects, where are we at with regards to scope and schedule and budget, and how, you know, what are the challenges, what resources do we need, who do we need to talk to in order to make these projects happen. So every project on the customer end, whether you're public sector or private sector, every project will need a champion over there, somebody who is going to help get that project from concept to completion. And similarly, all of those projects on the consultant side also need a champion, somebody who's going to help organize what needs to be organized to make sure the project moves along like it should be, like it's envisioned.
Sure.
So that's what my job is.
So I want to key in a little bit on one of the things you pointed out. So why don't you describe a little bit how your department looked, how the aviation services division looked when you walked in to KPG, and how does that compare to what the department looks like today? And I know you mentioned that it's still a one-man show, but I'm sure you have experienced significant changes over the last 2 years.
Yeah. So if you look at the aviation division right now, it consists of one person, which is me. But the teams that we have put together across not only the company, but from outside subconsultants that we use, outside vendors that we use, that's where we get all of our power from, right? So came in the door. So before I got here, no aviation services were provided. Except for one project. They had one project going on. In fact, they had gotten an aviation project at the airport that I worked at. I was still there at the time. So, and it was actually me that hired this company well before I signed on here, because the company impressed me with what they were about and the people that were here. And so this company, Aviation Services, is new, and it's new in terms of a division, new in terms of the idea itself. Mainly what people were working on here were municipal projects, engineering, architecture, landscape projects for cities and counties and stuff, but not on airports, which is a whole different environment. Yeah, so what the aviation department looked like before I got here was there wasn't one. And after I got here, there's one now that's on paper, and I'm the person who's doing it. And I supplement the division by pulling in resources from different departments within the company. So while the aviation services division is only one person big, formally, I have 100 people who I can pull from for projects. And then I have much more than that of folks who I've networked with outside of the company who we can pull in for help as well.
Sure. It sounds like the kind of dynamic that you have at your current job is pretty much relying on a lot of those individuals that work side by side with you to make sure that your projects get completed.
Yeah, that's what my whole role is here, is to get those people and those resources organized and all moving in the same direction on these projects that we're contracted for.
Sure. And if we stay along those lines, I want to hear a little more about what would you say are the challenges of working in an organization's newly established division? I think you kind of touched base a little bit on the resources aspect of it, but any other challenges that you would highlight from that kind of experience?
Yeah, well, the biggest challenge is this is a company that's been around for 28 years, historically hasn't done any aviation work. And so when I'm coming in the door as new to consulting and new to the company, creating a new division, there's a little bit of internal resistance, right? What are you doing? What are you working on? Why are we doing it? It's all of those things. We've been, as an organization, we've been chasing different kinds of projects for 30 years. And now when I come in the door, we're saying, oh, now we're going to start looking at some of these other projects that are on airports, and they require different standards and they require different ways of doing business because airports are different than, your city and your county and stuff, right? They have different facilities and different pavements and everything is different. So there's a little bit of resistance to change, even though the people here I consider to be really flexible, really, really adaptable. There's still that subtle resistance. So what it means is I got to come in and enroll the people of the organization, not only in the projects that we're doing, but in the concept of looking at aviation work, in just getting them invested in that idea that we can do this sort of work and we can do it well.
Right. And I think you're talking about resistance to change and how to change that. So what would you say are pretty much the key aspects to getting people to move from that resistance to more of an acceptance?
Well, so a couple of things. One is, one thing I've learned over a long time is that you have to show up every day, that you have to continue to show up when people may not be interested or totally enrolled in what you're doing and keep putting your ideas forward, right? So any venture you're going to get into, if you're starting any entrepreneurial venture or any new division or any whatever, you're going to have a period there where most of the people around you may not like what you're doing or may not be invested in what you're doing, right? And so there's a period there when you come in where you have to say, okay, I'm here, here's what we're going to do. And then you got to keep doing it day after day. But, and then on top of that, you have to be really, I say the second thing is you have to be really clear about what you're doing. And not only the what, but why. Why are you doing this work? Why is it important in the world? How is it going to change things? Right? And being able to tell that story to people in a way that they can understand it. And that's how I phrase all of these projects. So when we're going after a project and I'm talking to my to potential project partners about this thing we're going after. I'm not talking always about, well, what it is, the what, where, the who, and all those are important data points, but what's really gets them enrolled, I found, is when we start talking about why this project is coming to be, what will happen as a result of it, the change in the world that we're going to get as a result of it, and why it should matter to them, right? As somebody who's coming into this project, why does it matter to you? And once they start hearing that over and over again, it becomes easier to get excited about what's going on.
Yeah, I think that the component you're probably that I hear from your comments is just having that open communication with the entire team and those people that are being included in the project.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Communication in a big basket sort of way. That's a big term, right? I mean, what does it mean? Different things, different people. But within that, I would say being able to speak to how these people are. How my potential project partners are seeing this project from their perspective. You know, what can be exciting about it, why it's important. Start looking at it from their perspective versus me standing there saying, you know, here's what we want to do. Here's, you know, what it is. Here's, you know, when it's due and all these other things, all these other data points. Getting beyond that, getting into the story of sure. why it's important.
Yeah. So why don't we go, take a step back and look at if we look at KPG as an organization overall, how would you describe the growth that the company's experiencing in general?
Sure. So the company is always consistently grown. So what we haven't done is gone crazy on one end and, you know, accepted more projects than we can reasonably handle. And on the other end, we haven't been so conservative that we haven't grown. So we're sort of a nice spot right in the middle, where through smart leadership, through smart management of our resources, we've been able to grow as our demand for our services has grown. So one of the things we really work on here is getting repeat business. We want to work with you. But more importantly, we want to work with you for more than just this one project. We want to keep working with you into the future. And so as we build those relationships and start doing these projects and getting that repeat business, our portfolio starts growing. And then we'll start bringing in people gradually to help us with that as we go. So I'd say, you know, the short answer is, incremental and consistent growth is how we've been doing it for the last 30 years.
Sure. I think that's with any young and entrepreneurial business, usually there's that tendency to just push for growth regardless of what you have at hand. And something that really caught my attention of your comments was the smart leadership and smart growth. Could you talk a little more about that? How does that look like? What would you describe as some attributes of smart leadership and smart growth?
So if you're looking at, so let's look at the leadership side of it. So what leadership is, how I've defined it, is we're essentially, leadership is the act of moving other people to action on a mission. That's what the job is. The job is trying to get other people to move on something that you've already identified that you want to do. One of the ways we do that here is by actually identifying what it is we want to do, right? So we tend to be very clear about the projects and the clients that are in our wheelhouse, right? Type of work that we do. And similarly, we're clear about how we do our work, right? The signature of our work, such that we produce a certain quality of work. And we want to continue producing that when times are great, when times are slow. And so to do that, we have to manage carefully the projects that we have, but also the people, the resources that we have as well. On the client side, when we're dealing with the client, you know, what they're seeing is, okay, we have this company, and what they're waiting for are the deliverables that come at different intervals for the design process, right? Say it's 30% or 60% completion or 90% completion. We give them work. We say, here's where we're at. And they look at it and they say, okay, you know, good, change this, think about that. On our end, we have to manage not only that one project, but all the other projects that are going on, the new projects that are coming in, the old projects that are wrapping up, new people that are coming on board, other people who are quitting. Right? There's all this sort of background organized chaos that's happening, even though on the client side, they're only seeing that, okay, here's the deadline day, and here's what they said they would give me. So that becomes a real challenge.
One of the things, judging from your comments, would be that you're looking at what not only what you have at hand right now in front of you, but also how does that look moving forward and looking into the future. So that would be more of the planning aspect of any projects and upcoming projects, correct?
Yeah. So every consulting company that is like we are, they all wish they had the crystal ball. they could go into the secret conference room, peer into the crystal ball, and they would be able to look out 2 or 3 years and be able to see that, you know, what's coming in front of them. And most of us are only able to look out, you know, about a year or so. And sometimes it's a lot less than that. Some periods it's more than that, some periods it's less than that. And so there's always this game that's happening of, okay, here's where we're at in terms of the number of active projects, number of things that are going on. Here's where we want to be. Here's where we think we'll be. And here's what we're expecting, right? There's all these different sort of looks into the future that we're doing. So we're trying to plan. Not only are we trying to do all the work that we have right now, but we're also trying to plan for that future, right? Because we have people who work here, people whose livelihood is at stake here. We don't want to be a company that comes in and blows up with a whole bunch of projects and goes crazy and hires people only a few months later to lay a bunch of people off, right? It's just not going to work. So there's really an art to it, looking to that future.
You talked about something really important, and that was kind of my next question, of how does an organization or business prepare for to better manage or handle growth?
Sure. A couple of thoughts. One is that you really want to define your core offering, your product offering, what it is you do. And by understanding what it is you do, then you'll simultaneously understand what it is you don't do. Right? Because when you're working in these sort of, if you're a consultant or starting at some sort of startup, it may be that you're saying we're offering service or product X. And somebody comes to you and says, yeah, but I really need like this other thing, which is sort of related, or, right? Then all of a sudden you're like, okay, now we offer X and we offer Y. Right? And then it's then pretty soon, if you're not careful about it, you can be doing a number of different things and your focus gets diluted on what you're doing. So one of the things I would say is by getting really clear on what your core product is, right? Being able to say, yes, it's what we do. No, we don't do that. The other thing that I would say is the people who are in the leadership roles in the organization, whether they're, you know, founder, CEO, COO, whatever that role is, whatever that leadership role is that they need to be looking at the people and the processes of the organization, right? So what all organizations are fueled by people, right? You gotta have people to do things. So who are these people I have? How can we get processes within the organization straightened out such that we can do this sort of work while keeping our costs low? And how can I get these people working better together, bringing them their whole selves to work, so to speak, right? Giving that 100% or that 90% or whatever you require of them each day. How can we do that? How can we create the conditions to pull that out of people?
Sure.
I would say it would be the second.
Yeah, I think you mentioned something really interesting that grabbed my attention, and that's the whole idea of understanding what you don't provide. I think it's for some for some businesses, it's pretty straightforward. If you're an ice cream shop, you sell ice cream. You're not going to provide, you know, some other services. But when it's a consulting firm, there is that pretty much open limits to some degree that if somebody walks in with a problem, if you want to, you might be able to provide it. But I think it takes me to my next question, which is what kind of impact can growth have on quality services and client satisfaction itself?
If you're running a company, you've defined what your product is. That's the thing you're offering, and you're experiencing a lot of demand for that product. So you're growing, which is good. That's what usually most people want, right? They want to grow. You get to a point where if you're not keeping an eye on your people and your processes, right? If you're not building your teams up, if you're not by bringing in the right people, moving people around as they need to be moved around, all of the leadership things that center around people. If you're not, if you haven't identified and established your processes around your product or service delivery, what it looks like, how you deal with your vendors, if you haven't done all that stuff, then all growth is going to do is expose more of whatever weakness you have. So if you, you know, people are either buying a product or service, that's, you know, that's what we're doing, right? So if your product isn't getting to them when they expect it because you're backlogged, right, because you're unable to fulfill your promise on your end of it, you've just shot yourself in the foot with your customer, right?
Absolutely.
And people nowadays, right, if I don't get my Amazon thing in 2 days, this just happened, right? If I don't get my package in 2 days, then all of a sudden, like, what is happening in the world, right? Where is my stuff, right? And that's how we've been sort of acculturated now to that expectation, right? Company says it's going to do something, it's got to fulfill. It can't be like, well, we're going to ship it out in a month. Right? It's just not going to work, right? And so if we're not paying attention to those people, those processes on the back end, all that growth is going to do is expose our weakness. And then what will happen is, we're going to be running around like crazy people trying to fix that, trying to fix the problems instead of getting to the root, right? So you fix the problem of it needs to ship today. That's fine. We can all run around crazy and get something shipped out today. But if we don't fix the root of that problem, why it was not going to be shipped today in the first place, for whatever reason, we're going to experience that same problem again tomorrow or next week, right? So it's got to be about fixing these core problems, and that's always around people and processes.
Sure, and I think so the follow-up to that question, because it would be, what kind of impact would a significant growth have on your employees and their performance? Because that pretty much covers the product and the process itself, but what about the employees and their performance?
Sure, so from an employee perspective, the deal is this, that we can all sprint, but we can't sprint a marathon. That's how it works. Sprints are always going to be short-term in nature. Otherwise, we're going to burn people out, right? So when I'm giving talks about, I give talks to different groups on leadership and topics like that. One of the things I like to bring up is that there's a study done, a survey done of HR managers. HR manager. They ask these HR managers, tell me, what is the number one reason people are leaving your company, right? So these HR managers are doing exit interviews, they're trying to figure out, you know, what's happening, why are my good people turning over, right? And the answer they get back is that up to half of them are saying that I'm leaving because I burned out, right? So we're pushing our folks as our business grows, if we're not properly planning for our people resources, the people who we have, and the processes they go through to fulfill the work, if we're not paying attention to that stuff, it's going to increase the load on them, the emotional load, the workload, right, such that they end up working longer hours, they end up working on the weekends, like I was doing last weekend, right? And you can do that for a little bit, but if you ask too much for too long, you're going to lose people. Right? So the effect is in the short term that people get a little bit irritated, right? When you're monkeying with their schedule, right? When you're saying, hey, we need you this weekend. Hey, we need you to stay late. Hey, we need you to do what you did last month, but we need twice as much of it, right? It becomes harder on them. So if we're not paying attention, so I guess the core of it is, we're not paying attention to our people, developing our people, bringing in enough people, moving people around as we need to, getting our teams right. If we're not paying attention to that or the processes about doing the work itself, that growth is going to have a negative impact.
Sure, and I think the next step to that would be also making sure that your employees have the right tools and resources that they're going to need to be able to perform at the standards that you want them to.
Totally agree. Yeah.
So the next question that I have here is with regards to how do you measure KPG's success in serving your clients?
One of the big ways that we measure around here is on repeat work. So people will, you know, if you provide service for somebody and you send them a card in the mail that says, please rate our service, right? Or you ask them in the face-to-face interview, how is the service? Everyone's going to say, you know, fine or good or, I mean, right? Because we don't want to be jerks and stuff like that. So people won't mail the card back to you, right? You just won't hear anything. So the way that we tend to measure here is, are we getting more work from the clients that we've already worked with, right? Are they coming back for more? Because that's the action that tells us that whatever we did last time was good. You know, met or exceeded what they wanted from us. So we pay attention to that. And our sort of outlook here is that we want to get new customers, new clients, but what we really want are repeat clients. We want people that we want to generate that, start that relationship, and then have a working relationship for a long time. There's been some clients we've been working with since the doors opened, which is a testament to the people before us that came through that were able to nurture those projects and relationships.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I think I had an interview with another executive at the consulting firm, and that's exactly the same response I got with regards to customer satisfaction and repeat clients. So I'm going to shift gears here a little bit, and I'm going to ask you, I mentioned at the beginning of our interview how you started in the public sector and then transitioned to the private sector. Having worked on both of these environments, what do you enjoy the most about the private sector and the public sector?
A lot of years in both. The public sector, what I really enjoyed was that you were in direct you were working essentially for the people of that community. So I really had, in the job that I had a lot of community interaction, a lot of neighborhood groups and a lot of city council meetings and a lot of ways to interact with the people who lived there. And among people who lived in other cities who were coming in, right? Airports will attract people from neighboring cities as well, especially if there's noise issues or other issues like that. So, but I love that aspect of working for the people. You know, there's some sort of thought going around out there. It's been around for a long time, which is that government is the problem, right? And if people who say that who don't actually work in government, because when you work in government, you are among a number of the brightest people out there, and they're not working there to get rich. There's no money in government like there is in the private sector. Right? The reason they're working there is because they feel that they want to make a contribution to something that's bigger than they are, right? To the community that they live in or that they work in. So I worked with some of the brightest people, some people who've been there for 30 years, 35 years, and in doing the same sort of work, and you ask them, like, well, what's the deal with that? And they always, you know, tease about, you know, I've been here the longest and I've seen the city grow and all this stuff, but really they're there because of the work that they do. They get a value out of it that they wouldn't be able to get anywhere else. So in the public side, that was really inspiring, and I really worked with a lot of first-class people in government, not only at the city I worked in, but in other agencies that we liaised with. In the private side, especially at this company here, the people are really great. So this company has managed to, you know, grow to 100+ people, and the people who work here are really fantastic. So it makes coming to work a lot better when the people you work with, you know, tend to be, again, more first-class people who are really technically sound in what they do, but also able to, you know, get along and have fun and see projects, you know, see the bigger sort of impact that they're having.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things when I arrived at the Raleigh-Durham International Airport was I was impressed by the number of people that had been here for so long. And the comment I kept on getting was they enjoy working with their crew, with the people that worked around them. So that speaks volumes of the organization itself.
Yeah. Very same experience.
Yeah, so Jonathan, I want to ask you a little bit more. I'm going to switch gears to a different topic, and I want to hear a little more about Sandcastle Company and your experience as the founder and owner of Sandcastle. Tell me a little bit about that experience.
So Sandcastle is essentially a side hustle that I started up not too long ago. This is a passion of mine, which is focused on how can we make better leaders? How can we turn existing leaders who may not be as great as they can be into people who are regarded as great leaders? So this is a leadership training sort of organization. Right now, the organization is made up of just me, right?
Sure.
So it's a one-person organization, intentionally. This is something that I do in my sort of hours before and hours after and weekend hours. And it's a way for me to sort of talk more directly to folks who are in leadership roles, who have that great responsibility, that great privilege being in those roles. How can we become better at that job? Because if we get better as leaders, not only do our lives get better, but the people that we work with get better as well.
Yeah, and now I'm interested in hearing a little bit more. You said that it's a one-man show intentionally. How come?
Yeah, because I want to keep this intentionally small because I want to be in every aspect of it. So if I were looking out a couple years on this company, if it grew to more than two or three or four people, I would be shocked, because basically I like the hands-on quality of it. And once it gets, if it were to get to be something bigger, if it got to be the size of this company, then my role within it would change for some period of time. And I don't want it to change. I want to keep doing what I want to do, which is be right there on the front lines working with folks, either in a coaching capacity, in workshops, speaking to their organizations, doing that real sort of hands-on, visible work.
Sure. Now, as a business owner, what do you think are the most important lessons you have learned from that experience?
Well, how much time do we have? let me frame it this way for the sake of brevity. If you are starting a side hustle as an entrepreneur, you're beginning something on the side. The biggest challenge you're going to have, especially if you're someone like me, you know, 41 years old, family, married, right, full-time gig on the side that's demanding work in and of itself. If you're like that, But even if you're a younger person and you're not married yet, but you got a full-time gig going on, the thing is that you don't have a lot of time, right? We're all granted the same amount of time each week. That's how it works. And if you have a big chunk of that taken away to your primary job, then you're going to have very few real effective hours left over each week to do this thing that you want to do. So the big lesson for me has been, okay, I've got limited time. That means I need to be laser focused on exactly what it is I'm going to do, right? On exactly this. And you can't do too much of it, right? Unless you're trying to turn this thing into your full-time gig, you can't do a lot of it, but you got to spend that time really wisely. And that's been the key takeaway. If you're thinking about starting a business out there, or if you have a business that's going right now, I would laser focus in on that one or two things that you do, and I would do that. I would try to stay away from anything that distracted me from doing those couple of things.
Sure. And this is for a Masters of Entrepreneurship class, so we're looking at a bunch of people that are trying to grow their business or start their own business. So along those lines, what career advice would you have for some of those people that are looking to take tomorrow's executive leadership positions?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, I've got a book that I've written that's coming out on this very topic. It's due out in a couple of weeks. And it's called Future Leader. Okay. And so this book, because this question that you're asking is probably the most salient, but not only the most salient at any time, but the most salient right now in this particular moment. So this book that I've written, this is the playbook for leaders, right, who are looking to they want to more efficiently steer their organizations amid these two forces that are acting on, amid this force of generational churn, the generations, right? You've heard about the millennials, the baby boomers. And amid the force of technological change. So we're at this moment right now in 2018, 2019, right, where the very makeup of the workforce is changing dramatically from what it was over the last 30 years as the generations age. Okay? And at the same time, at this very same moment right now, there's a massive change happening on the technology side, technology being able to change not only what you do, but how you do it, the process by which you do it. Right? So the question is, going forward, is how can leaders at this time prepare for those two big changes? And that's what this book looks at. And part of the reason I bring it up is because what the research has shown, and this is your question here is really well-timed, because what the research has shown is that leadership right now in a number of organizations is underperforming. It's not doing as well as it could do. And it's not just anecdotal. There's research into this people have done that that proves this case. Now, if you think of leadership as leaving a wake behind you, like if you imagine a boat, a speedboat, and all of that wake that's behind the boat, that's what leadership leaves behind, and we can measure that. Right? We can see whether it's good or not. And right now the evidence is saying that it's underperforming. Now you take these leadership people who are in these leadership positions who are using these leadership models that they learned from somewhere, they saw on TV, wherever they got them from. And these leadership models now, which are already underperforming, are getting further stressed. They're getting further agitated by this massive generational change, by this technological advancement that's happening. And so that's the real question, is what do we do right now to prepare for especially the next 10 years, which are going to be critical.
And Jonathan, what's the title of your book and when is it coming out?
Sure. So it's due out in a couple of weeks here, December 1st, and the title is Future Leader.
Future Leader.
And I think, I want to, I described the problem a little bit. If I had to give you the what I'm seeing is going to be the big change going forward, something that, that people in your class, people who are entrepreneurs, can take away is that the world of work is changing such that we're moving to what I've heard referred to as a person-to-person economy, right? No okay. longer is it like, well, it's just business. It's not personal, right? There's no more of that. That we're moving to what I've heard coined as a P2P, right, economy. And so, you know, what leaders need to do is how do they move, how are they going to move and motivate others? And the answer to that, that's, you know, talked about in the book, but the basic answer to that that we can take away is that we need to show up more as people in these jobs, especially if you're in a leadership role. We need to show up more as people than as some sort of automaton or spreadsheet that walks around, right? And that's a big thrust. So, like, we're going to be consciously working to build trust, build our emotional intelligence, build our relationships. And there's a number of other things that we talk about in the book, but it's talking more about showing up as a person at work and what that means and how it can help your team just do great.
All right. Well, Jonathan, I want to thank you for taking the time for this interview. It's been a pleasure talking to you today. And sure my classmates will definitely enjoy hearing from what you have to say. So once again, thank you.
You bet. Jose, thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you.